I think it expresses my, perhaps my vision of history, that history is quite random, and that the best historians can really do is walk along the beach of history and just pick up the odds and ends that are washed onto the shore by the sea of the past. And that really this is what I'm doing in the blog. I'm not doing it in a systematic fashion. I'm just picking up the pebbles, the messages in the bottle, the pieces of wood, the, you know, various shoes that have been discarded and washed upon the beach, and enjoying them and sharing them with a wider public.
Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here.
Is this your first interview as Dr. Beach?
It is. As Dr. Beach is my first interview.
All right, nice.
I just find it extraordinary that that Viking knowledge of North America never leaked into Europe. I just cannot account for that. I find it amazing that this isn't better known in the United States. I mean, what on earth was he seeing? And again, I would just love to say that he's an unreliable chronicler, but he's actually a very reliable chronicler. Historians always comment on how reliable he is. This wasn't something he'd heard from someone else. He saw it himself. He didn't see them at a distance. He sat and watched them. How do you explain that? I have not the slightest idea. Well, I think this is something that's just come up again and again, and perhaps it's been for me the biggest story of writing the blog.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. I hope you all had an outstanding holiday season. Allow me to offer you a slight apology here. Usually we like to have an episode for you around the turn of the year, but we just didn't manage to get it done this year. It's been a crazy holiday season for me and the BOA staff. So in a lot of ways, I'm kind of glad to see the holidays in my rearview mirror as things are already starting to settle down here at BOA HQ. We're hoping to get the episodes out to you on a more regular basis. I'd say, you know, not necessarily week to week, but certainly every 10 days or so now that the calendar has turned to 2011. No matter when we get the shows out to you, rest assured, my goal each and every edition of the program is to bring you a home run interview. And hopefully this week's edition of the program is no exception. Our guest this week goes by the name of Dr. Beachcombing. Don't let the tongue-in-cheek name fool you. Dr. Beachcombing is a fantastic writer and an amazing storyteller. And he's appearing here on BOA Audio and giving us his first ever interview as Dr. Beachcombing. Chances are you have checked out his website by now, Beachcombing's Bizarre History Blog. Really one of the breakout sources of information in esoterica of 2010. I'm going to go so far as to call Dr. Beachcombing one of the breakout stars in esoterica of 2010. He puts out some seriously well-researched and well-written material literally day after day at Beachcombing's Bizarre History Blog. And if you haven't checked out the website yet, you definitely want to do that because his stuff is top-notch. Now, it's a little bit difficult to preview the episode because it comes in right at 2 hours. It's just jam-packed with stuff. And just to give you a slight thumbnail, we're going to cover burned libraries, widely believed historical myths, forgotten kingdoms and lost realms, hinge moments in history, and stories that reflect something or someone being in the wrong place or wrong time in history. Among the tales you'll hear from Dr. Beachcombing in this conversation are the story of the sandwich in space, the Confederate exiles who left America to settle in Brazil after the South lost the Civil War, a 16th century account of witnessing unicorns in captivity, the Italian Shakespeare theory, and the Republic of Rough and Ready. And that's really a handful of the many, many stories you're going to hear on this edition of the program here with Dr. Beachcombing. Along the way, we're also going to find out more about this mysterious Dr. Beachcombing. He's going to pull the curtain back just a little bit to give us a glimpse of who really is the writer who has electrified online esoterica over the past year. Who is Dr. Beachcombing? You're not going to find out exactly, but you're going to find out a lot more about him here on the program. Altogether, really, it is a conversation that features a plethora of fascinating and strange stories that are sure to entertain, amuse, and boggle your mind. Coming to us direct from somewhere in Italy and giving us his first ever interview, it's the mysterious and enlightening Dr. Beachcombing. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Dr. Beachcombing, allow me to read you a little bit of his bio. Dr. Beachcombing lives part of his time in the village of Little Snoring in an undisclosed English county, not Norfolk, and the rest of his time in an undisclosed village in Tuscany. He likes villages. He is particularly curious about the strange and the unexpected in records of the past, exceptions that prove or disprove rules. He increasingly suspects that there are no rules, but that's another story. Over the years, he has put together several bulging file cabinets full of these strange and unexpected details. He does not expect his website to be read as a normal blog. It is more a library of the damned, that every so often the brave will turn up in internet searches. His website, of course, is Beachcombing's Bizarre History Blog, and you can find that at beachcombing.wordpress.com, and you want to spell that BEACHCOMBING.wordpress.com. Beachcombing's Bizarre History Blog. If you haven't checked this website out, folks, you are in for a real treat. You will be reading for days on end the sheer wealth of material that can be found at Beachcombing's Bizarre History Blog. Again, I can't put this guy over enough. He really is one of the breakout stars in esoterica in 2010, and it is a real thrill for me not only to get his first ever interview, but also to showcase his fantastic work for all of the awesome BOA Audio listeners. With all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on November 27th, 2010. Dr. Beachcombing shares tales of bizarre history on BOA Audio Season 6. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. I'm very excited about this week's edition of the program because our guest has really sort of burst onto the scene here in the last 6 months or so with his blog, and it's becoming increasingly popular day in and day out, and I'm hearing more and more about it as the days and weeks go by. So as I was collecting guests here for Season 6, I put out a call to him to see if we could get him on the show. He's never done an interview before in this incarnation, I guess you could say. So it's his first interview as Dr. Beach. I'm talking about Dr. Beachcombing. He's the man behind Beachcombing's Bizarre History Blog, and you can find that at beachcombing.wordpress.com. And as I said, it's really picking up steam. It's taking the scene by storm. I'm seeing more and more references to it all over the internet. So it's exciting to get him on the program here to talk about how this all came about, and you know, some of his favorite stories that are featured at Beachcombing's Bizarre History Blog. So without any further ado, welcome to the program, Dr. Beachcombing.
Nice to be with you, Tim.
Well, let's start out with, you know, the bio, the background, the origins of Dr. Beach. I know, obviously, this is a pseudonym, so I don't want to pry too much into your, you know, your real world, your real life, but, you know, who is Dr. Beach, and how did Beachcombing's Bizarre History Blog come about?
Well, it came about really about 6 or 7 months ago. I'd been through a long period of illness, and I just wasn't able to do the writing that I'd used to do, I mean, publishing books and the like, because I simply didn't have the energy or the physical well-being, really, to concentrate. And so I decided to do blogging under the name Beachcombing because I felt it was a way, really, just to be able to produce something every day. And as often happens with these things, I started, and I think this is the experience of many bloggers, and fell in love with it. I found it was almost therapeutic to write 500, 600, 1,000 words a day. And especially as I was often writing on things outside my field, this proved a great joy. And so off I went.
Are you a historian by profession, or obviously you're a writer, so, I mean, how did the whole history aspect of it come about?
Well, I am a historian profession, and I'm also a writer, But history was always, it has always been my first, so it was very naturally into history that I would pry. I teach at university, and so I therefore have a speciality, but I also have two or three other periods that I'm particularly interested in, and lots of smaller subjects that I'm curious about. And so really, this was an opportunity for me to get outside my comfort zone, really, and stick my nose into a lot of places that I'd never really had an excuse to go before.
And some of the stuff you feature on the blog, I mean, this is pretty obscure information. Like, how do you find these stories that you dig up and present on the blog?
Well, over the years, I've read a lot around history. And so what happens really is I just have a lot of notebooks and a lot of notes going back 20 odd years.
Oh, wow.
And I try and pull things out and then build on them using sources taken from libraries, taken from online. And then, of course, the other thing, and this is where the whole aspect of blogging is so wonderful, is that then people write into me with suggestions for other stories or corrections or additions to stories I've put on. And so then, in an ideal world, the stories just continue to grow like a snowball going downhill.
Yeah, I've noticed that on the posts, that at the close of them, then there's some additional material usually tacked on that you receive from a reader. So, you know, it's like a communal situation there.
That's right, yes.
You mentioned in the Dead Language Parrots post about how, you know, sometimes you have a particularly interesting morsel, a fascinating story, and then when you sit down and triple-check the facts on it, you find out that it's a misunderstanding or an exaggeration. So I guess talk a little bit about that phenomena that seems to happen, you know, as you're presenting these bizarre historical stories.
Well, I think this is something that's just come up again and again, and perhaps it's been for me the biggest story of writing the blog, is that for years, lots of these stories I've talked about at dinner parties or when I meet someone and we get to chat about history, and often I've just not checked the facts. I've trusted books. But when I actually write a blog post on one of these strange stories, I then obviously go deeply into it and make sure the facts are okay. And I find it extraordinary how often, when you actually check things, the facts don't work out, that these stories are often inventions or misunderstandings. And the Dead Parrot post, the Dead Language post, just for your listeners, this was a tribe in South America who had been wiped out and their language only survived in the tongues of parrots. There were a couple of parrots that had been captured from their last village when the tribe had been exterminated. And as soon as I started looking into that story, all the alarm bells went off. And actually, that's the one happy story of the 150-odd blogs I've written, where despite many people online, in books, saying that this story is a legend, I was actually able to trace the original reference. And so that story stands up. But there are many, many stories. I'll just give you one example. There's a celebrated battle in the 18th century where the Austrian army accidentally fights itself in Transylvania. Instead of attacking the Turkish army, it accidentally, at dusk, sets upon itself. You have an animal biting its own tail.
Yeah.
And supposedly 10,000 Austrians were killed. I'd often talked and told this story to people over the years. It's just complete legend. There's no basis in fact at all.
It's interesting to see, you know, when you sift through these, how many turn out to be fact and how many turn out to be fiction.
That's right, and I think that this is something that's become something of an obsession with me. When I teach my students at university and I talk about history, I always say we are lying dogs. We constantly manipulate the past, we constantly misremember it, we constantly misunderstand it. And I always give the example of studies looking at middle-aged couples or elderly couples remembering their courtship from when they're younger. And the classic question is, when did you kiss for the first time? And when you look at these memories, you can bet your bottom dollar that the person will remember kissing under a full moon and a starry sky. So actually, if you go back and research these things, certainly my memory of my first kiss with my wife was under a starry sky. In fact, when you go back and look, I worked out that it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon in a dull November when there wasn't a moon in sight. And I think that this is the problem with human beings. We're constantly rejigging our memories. A post that should come up in a few days' time, I was looking at the evidence from the Kennedy killing, from perhaps our most important witness for that, Jean Hill, who died in 2000, unfortunately. She's the so-called lady in red who was virtually on the pavement about 4 metres from Kennedy when the bullet went into Kennedy's body, or the bullets went into Kennedy's body. And her opinion are always quoted by conspiracy theorists. And in the post, I actually just set out her memories over the years, and you can see over the space of the 30 years, I mean, even at the beginning, because of the various videos and photographs that survive, we know that she misunderstood or misremembered some things. But over the years, her memories grow, her memories develop, and because there have been so many people attentive to her descriptions, because clearly this is an important historical moment, luckily we can check, and we can see that slowly she's embellished, changed, and in the end really changed out of recognition this 30 seconds of her life. But of course, the difference is with most of us most of the time is that we have no sources with which we can check.
Exactly, yeah, exactly, especially with this, with the history you're talking about on the blog, which is like super, super old history. We're not talking about the 60s here, we're talking about like the 1600s.
I mean, but especially, even more so if you go back to the times of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
I mean, it becomes very depressing, really. I mean, when you look just how difficult it is to write history within our grandparents' lifetime, and then you think that we actually have the pretension to write history for the Roman Empire or the early Middle Ages, where often we just have a few thousand words for a century. I mean, really, it's almost a hopeless endeavor from the beginning.
Well, that's a good segue, actually, because you mentioned on the blog you have like 8 categories. So I guess we'll sort of tackle these categories and go through them, because it's a good overview for you know, for people who haven't checked out the blog yet, for the kind of different stuff that's there. So let's start, as I said, a good segue here, because the first one in the 8 categories is burning libraries, books and texts that we have lost. So talk a little bit about some of the stuff you've uncovered in that realm.
Well, over the years, I built up a huge file of books, texts, in some cases inscriptions, but anyway, written things that we know once existed but that have since disappeared. And I found this quite romantic, I suppose, that I love books as I'm talking to you. I'm sitting in a room surrounded with 2,000 or 3,000 books, and
wow.
I've always been fascinated by this fact that really so many of the books of antiquity, the Middle Ages, and really even so many of the books from, say, the 19th century, in the case of some rare books anyway, have not come through to us, have not survived. And I cut my historical teeth as a medieval historian. And so for me, I'm always very conscious of these books that we've lost. And the truth is that by now we're in the 21st century, if these books have not turned up. I mean, it's not like archaeology where you can hope to dig up a sword or a type of casket or a particular grave with particular gold decoration. If books and manuscripts have not turned up by now, and they were written prior to the 16th century, then almost certainly they are lost forever. There's just an outside chance with Roman texts that a few parchments are there in the Egyptian sands. And so what I've tried to do slowly in the tag with burning libraries is build up a list, a bibliography of the books we've lost. And it's surprising how scholars, no one really has tried to do this before. I mean, it could be a blog all in itself, you know, a book every day, one of the books we've lost.
How do you know that they're lost, like from subsequent references to them kind of thing?
Right, so subsequent references would be one thing. Another possibility is sometimes we have a fragment of them. Yeah, so sometimes this works. And sometimes we actually, they survived into modern times, and these are the really heartbreaking ones. They survived perhaps into the 17th century. We have a very good record of them. Perhaps we even have a few words copied out, and then they were lost in a fire.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So sometimes the very old texts almost make it, but then just at the end. I mean, for example, the destruction of manuscripts in the Second World War was not small.
Yeah. Now, what about the Library of Alexandria? Because I've tried to look into this, you know, and it seems like it's shrouded in confusion itself. So what do you know about that whole story?
Well, one of the biggest controversies about the Library of Alexandria is how many texts there were actually there. What you've got to think about when you're dealing with Roman, Greek, and to an extent medieval texts, obviously there are no printing press. Things are being copied out by hand. And one of the elements that are most confused in transmission, in other words, where a copyist writing out a manuscript most often gets facts wrong, are with numbers. Because the nature of Roman numerals and Greek numerals, unlike the Arab numerals that we use, is that you just miss one digit off and things can change dramatically. Arab numbers are safer in that sense. And so we're not quite sure how big the Library of Alexandria was. But really, what I always say about the Library of Alexandria is this. I mean, the Library of Alexandria is probably the most famous library from antiquity that did not make it. But look, the truth is that every library from antiquity didn't make it. Libraries in antiquity were always in palaces. They were always at the centre of capital cities. They were the places that when cities went up in flames, I mean, these were some of the first places to disappear. And there is that moment in technology where from, say, I mean, the first millennium BC, when writing starts being transferred from clay tablets and inscriptions onto parchment, as soon as that step is made, then the chances, I mean, we're using a medium that is incredibly delicate. A Babylonian clay tablet will survive if we're lucky. But, I mean, what are the chances that parchment's going to survive? Unless we're very, very lucky and it's left there a meter under the sands of Egypt, every so often something turns up, then it's lost.
Yeah, and it makes you think a little bit about the times we're in now, too, with the written word seemingly, you know, falling out of favor and the digital word coming into prominence. Who knows what will ever become of your work, of my work, all the stuff that's online, you know. If there's like a nuclear holocaust or something, that stuff could all be wiped out forever.
I think there were two or three ways to look at that. I mean, I think the first thing that always strikes me is that there's just so much more writing now than ever before. And so, in a sense, even if it survives, the extent to which anyone will read it is doubtful. Because just with the numbers of blogs and writing online, I was talking to a poet recently who described publishing a poet online like putting a little paper boat and sending it down the Mississippi. I mean, the chances of it ever reaching the sea or ever being read, if you like, by a reasonable number of people has to be very low. And then, like you say, there's all the questions of disasters on the internet. I mean, what would happen? How much of this would actually survive? Probably relatively little. But, I mean, taking it from another angle, something that always fascinates me is even now, I mean, if you look back to a period, say, the late 19th century, when there was an awful lot of writing, I'm often surprised by actually how much stuff isn't described. I did a post, for example, on the ravens at the Tower of London, about which there are many legends. And it's very striking how we just don't know when the ravens arrived at the Tower of London, because even with the millions upon millions of words from the 19th century, from 19th century Britain, our records attach you. And even now, with our billions upon billions of words, there are whole areas of human experience that, even in the best case scenario, that will be lost.
Yeah, because I guess it all depends on the interests of the chronicler.
That's right, and I mean, there are the whole areas of life where either we're embarrassed or we don't have the interest to write things down.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. It's a weird sociology history in a way. Now, the next category on the list is cobblers, which I find really fascinating, and I enjoy your references to them, you know, over the course of the blog. These are widely believed historical myths. So you know, talk a little bit about that and give us some examples of famous cobblers.
I mean, cobblers is something that actually, with time, has grown to include all those areas where we manipulate and change the past. So it's not just historical myths. I mean, but I could give you a classic example of a historical myth, an idea often found in the United States, that the notion that spaghetti was invented in China and brought back by Marco Polo from China to Italy. I mean, this is just complete nonsense. We have records of pasta from a good century, at least, before Marco Polo ever set off on his mission. But this is something that then becomes big in American publicity in the 20s. It's then put in a famous film with Cary Grant in the 50s on Marco Polo, and from there it just takes off as an idea. And even in Italy, you sometimes find Italians telling you that spaghetti and pasta were invented by the Chinese and brought back by Marco Polo. And so I suppose I have a fascination for these kinds of stories. But I also like, I think for me, cobblers has come to include any misperception of the past. And if I can just put up here a flag for my all-time favourite blog story, and of course the way of the world is that no one ever reads this, no one's interested in it, but I just think it's a fabulous, fabulous story. It's all about Lowell, who was a celebrated astronomer at the turn of the 19th, 20th century. He did a lot of work on Mars. He wrote some, by our standards, fairly bizarre works on Mars, describing and deducing the civilization of Mars. But he also observed Venus a lot. And at the end of the 19th century, he found that using his special telescope system, and he was at a part of Arizona where the sky was particularly clear, there was no artificial light, he felt that he had some of the best views in the world from a telescope. By using this telescope, he was able to map on Venus a series of strange, and here I have to be careful, almost radial lines coming out of the center of Venus and slowly changing, but always leaving the center and moving across the surface of Venus. And he drew these on Venus, and he published these in several important astronomical publications. And as with his observations on Mars, some people agreed, some people disagreed. But then the 20th century wore on and telescopes got better, and no one could account for these lines, because as telescopes got better, these lines were nowhere to be seen. And it was only in the 90s in an astronomy journal that someone revisited this mystery, that an occultist wrote in and said, he's been drawing his own eye. What has actually happened is that he's created a telescope that's reflected his eye into it, and what he's seeing here are the veins on his own eye. And for me, this could almost stand as a metaphor for all our historical endeavours. We always want to look through the telescope at the past and understand things. And more often than not, we're drawing our own eye. In other words, we get in the way of what we want to understand.
Yeah.
And that both creates myths and creates confusion.
Yeah, that is a great metaphor for it. Absolutely, yeah. How about forgotten kingdoms? That's another section here, and that's countries, states, and regni that time forgot. This sounds fascinating because at first it conjures up ideas of Atlantis, but I'm sure there's more that are even more obscure that I haven't even heard of before.
That's right. This is another thing where over the past 10 years I've built quite a big file of examples of kingdoms or territories that we really in history have tended to forget. And I mean, just to give you a chance example, just the other day I did a blog on the Isle of Man. Now, the Isle of Man is the island which is halfway between Ireland and Britain.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small island. It's famous really perhaps today because it's some of the last places we have descriptions of the so-called fairy faith, in other words, where locals believed that fairies existed. We know nothing about it in antiquity. Our records just aren't good enough. We know that the Romans didn't occupy it, though they occupied Britain. And then slowly, in the Middle Ages, references start to bleed through to us. And what we learn is there's a little territory, a little kingdom of British Celts on this island, defending this island. And this kingdom survives from possibly the 6th century through to about the 9th century, when the Irish Sea is flooded by dragon boats, the Vikings arrive, and the Isle of Man becomes just an irresistible base for them. And at this point, the old British Celtic kingdom of Manow, as it was called, just disappears under the waves. And I always think very melancholy record. There were some Viking graves on the northwest of the island where Viking chieftains on Man were buried, and they were buried with presumably local women who had been sacrificed. And this is the end of the British Celtic kingdom of Manow. Now, if you read about the history of Manow, I mean, first of all, you will be very, very hard-pressed to find it. And even in history books on the Isle of Man, there are just a couple of paragraphs. And the bottom line is, the best evidence we have for it is actually a single inscription from the Isle of Man commemorating a king called Gwydion. And he is perhaps the only good evidence we have for a king of Manao. But there are lots of other examples, and possibly my all-time favourite example. I'm quite a royalist, being British. Mm-hmm. I've always had sympathies. Perhaps this is a typical someone fascinated by the past, but always sympathy for Europe's rather badly treated royal lines in the 20th century as they're slowly extinguished one by one. And there's a wonderful story from the Second World War that in, let's see, 1941, Yugoslavia, the Kingdom of Yugoslavia, finds itself in an absolutely desperate position. It's trying to remain neutral in the Second World War for very good reasons. But in the end, Germany gives it an ultimatum, and Yugoslavia slips over into the Axis, though it has a position of almost neutrality. At this point, very bravely, the officer class of Yugoslavia rises, creates a coup d'etat, gets rid of the regent of Yugoslavia, Paul, and replaces him with the young Yugoslav king. But at this point, the Wehrmacht, the German army, is pouring into Yugoslavia, and Yugoslav resistance lasts for maybe a week. I mean, with the best will in the world, there was no fighting the Wehrmacht.
Yeah.
And so the Yugoslav royal family, what's left of it, is evacuated to Britain. For the first couple of years after this, the British government, along with America, as America enters the war, supports the royalist resistance in Yugoslavia. But then, and this was a terrible, terrible mistake looking back, though perhaps it was an understandable mistake, the UK and Britain begin to back the communist partisans in Yugoslavia under Tito, who will later become the ruler of Yugoslavia. And the Yugoslav royal family, now based out of London, has this very unfortunate experience of finding itself, I mean, really trapped in an Allied land, but the Allied land supporting the enemy, the communist partisans, who are obviously dead set against a return for the royal family. But what happens is that Churchill, when the young king of Yugoslavia, the last true reigning king of Yugoslavia, gets married and his wife becomes pregnant, Churchill is desperate that the heir to the Yugoslav throne, who is still alive today, must be born on Yugoslav soil, because Churchill wants the royal family to have a chance after the war. And so Churchill, for a day, makes the hotel room in which they're staying Yugoslav territory. And I've written in this post about how this hotel room, for one day, for 24 hours, is another forgotten kingdom. It's the last trace of the Kingdom of Yugoslavia before Yugoslavia goes under the way and gets locked into its own rather unfortunate post-war destiny with Tito and more generally with the Eastern Bloc.
Wow, that's an amazing story. See, these are the kind of things that has made Beachcombing's Bizarre History blog a must-read for everybody out there. I mean, these kind of stories that are just stunning when you read them.
And they're forgotten, yeah.
I liked especially the Great Republic of Rough and Ready as well.
Yes.
That was pretty interesting.
There were several of these North America, I mean, I think the proper word is micronations or microstates, but these small states that crop up around the world where, I mean, for example, there's a notable example from Australia of a farmer who unilaterally declares independence. But there were some very enjoyable US examples, especially from the 19th century. I think there were four of towns, villages, or in one case, a whole district that declares independence because it gets annoyed at the federal government. And of course, the great thing about the Republic of Rough and Ready, basically they declared independence because they were irritated by mining taxes that the federal government had brought in. But I always loved the lack of stamina of the town in question that goes back over to the federal government, where they find that the local merchants in neighboring towns refuse to sell them alcohol because they say they're foreigners. And the idea of doing without alcohol and not celebrating independence Day was just too much, and so they go back into the federal family, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you got to get the booze, man. You got to, you know.
That's right. That's right.
The next segment here, the next category featured on Beachcombing's Bizarre History blog is the hinge moments, the moments when history changed. And these obviously sound pretty critical. So I guess share a little bit about these and you know, any in particular that stand out in your mind?
Well, there have been a few moments, I think, in history that are very obvious where world history changes. I mean, for example, the moment where Japan's high command in the Second World War decides to go ahead with Pearl Harbor. And I think that these are fairly easy to come by. Mm-hmm. But what I'm trying to do is find moments that are perhaps, again, a little bit more obscure, but when really we see the whole destiny of countries or the world changing. And I can give you many examples, but just to pick out a couple, one that I particularly enjoy dates from just after the Cuban Missile Crisis. British Secret Services are running a double agent, a Russian agent, out of Moscow. And I've never got to the bottom of this story, though the sources are absolutely impeccable. But this agent, who was very high up in Russia's secret command, is told by the British that if ever he believes Russia is preparing a preemptive attack on the West, in other words, a preemptive nuclear attack, mm-hmm. that he should signal this on the phone to his handler, who's working out of the British Embassy, by coughing and then deep breathing twice. Now, Britain was worried that this double agent had been found out by the Soviet Union, as indeed was the case. But at a certain point, his handler, in the middle of the night, gets a phone call, and it must have been, I mean, the most nightmarish of phone calls. He picked up the phone, and he heard coming down the line the signal warning him that the Soviet Union was about to launch a nuclear attack on the West, a surprise nuclear attack on the West.
Hmm.
He hears the cough and these two sighs. And the British handler had information, and luckily he had the common sense to know that the agent had been turned. Now, what I always ask myself is, if there had been someone who was a little bit incompetent, or someone who hadn't had the information to know the Soviet agent had turned, if he had got on the wire to London saying, look, we've had the signal, Russia is about to launch a nuclear attack.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those moments. I mean, goodness knows what could have happened. That phone call could have set off the Cold War. It would have finished the Cold War and started the Hot War, rather. And a very hot war. The other point about this story that I find extraordinary is, why on earth would the Soviet Union have encouraged someone that they tortured, an agent that they'd interrogated, to give that signal to the British?
Yeah.
Who knows? And one of the speculative answers to that some people give is that the agent in question did it without the Soviet police who turned him realizing what the code he was given. Was this perhaps his final act of revenge against the Soviet Union? Anyway, we'll never know. But that's a nice example of where things came very close to history changing for all of us.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that is strange. Yeah, maybe he was just a suicide attempt.
Well, I mean, he must have known that he was, this is Oleg Pukensky. I mean, he must have known that he was going to die. And in fact, there were lots of rumors about what happened to him, how he was killed. His KGB interrogator refers to him being executed. But there are rumors that he was actually burnt alive in a crematorium machine while other members of the KGB looked on. And our source for that is not a good source, but it just reminds you that for people who turned, a suicide mission would perhaps not have been completely inexplicable given what was likely to happen to him.
Yeah, exactly. I assume and presume that based on a lot of your writings that you've, you know, examined World War II pretty extensively. What do you make of all these sort of stories about Nazis escaping to Antarctica? I know you have one here of a Nazi.
That's me joking, really, because the story there is, this is about Kurt. You know that after the Second World War, there were these amazing stories about Japanese servicemen turning up on Pacific Islands for the next 35, 40 years.
Yeah.
And this is really me making fun of that and coming up with an extraordinary story of a machine named Kurt. Kurt was actually a Nazi weather machine. and he was dropped off on the coast of Canada. There's a fascinating episode in the Second World War called the Weather Wars. And the Weather Wars were basically wars with very few people included on both sides. In the Arctic Circle, because Germany needed to have its weather ships in the Arctic to know what weather fronts were coming into Europe, and above all for the Eastern Front.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Britain, and afterwards the US when the US enters the war, would do everything possible to keep the German weather boats out of the Arctic Circle. And so what you actually have are battles often between Eskimos, between the Inuit, between Arctic peoples, between Danes, Norwegians in the case of Greenland, and also on the Arctic Canadian coast. And it was this very shadowy war where very few people died, but the stakes were actually very high. And Germany at one point created a number of automatic broadcasters. And these were machines built by Siemens of old companies that were brought into the Arctic Circle and left because, rightly, they reasoned that they would be more efficient than men left behind. And also they felt that even if they were spotted, no one would think that they were German. And in fact, whenever they left them, they would leave cigarette boxes, American cigarette boxes around, writing in English, to persuade anyone who was going past that this was just some Allied material.
Yeah.
And for this reason, Kurt, on the coast of Canada, actually made it through to 1981 without being discovered. And so I suggested he was the last German soldier, in a sense, to be brought in from the Second World War. I mean, in any case, it's an extraordinary story, this machine tapping out weather messages all the way through the 60s, the 70s, and onwards. I don't know if his batteries lasted that long.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's interesting. It's yeah, that is strange. Now, what do you make of the idea that the Nazis escaped and let's start with Hitler. What do you think of that whole thing? You think he just pretty much died in the bunker, or there was more to it? Because I've heard various theories on
yeah,
what became of him.
I mean, there are theories that go all the way from him dying in the bunker, as you say, to the Earth being hollow and
yeah.
Hitler being taken away on a UFO. I suppose I'm fairly conventional. I think there is a strong case to be made that half of Hitler's skull is in a filing cabinet in Moscow. I think that the records are really so consistent between the various parties. And I think that what you have there, and perhaps there we go back to Cobblers, my section on myths in history,
mm-hmm.
is that sometimes when a very impressive individual, either for good or for evil, dies, the world just can't really get used to the fact that this person is dead. And I mean, Elvis is a version
of this. I was just going to say Elvis. Yeah.
But I mean, there are also examples that perhaps bring us closer to Hitler. So the idea, for example, that the Ceausescus, the Romanian dictators at the end of the communist regime in Romania, many Romanians are convinced that actually they're still alive, even though they were shot on live television. I mean, their shooting was actually filmed. Now, I think this leads us into the whole area of conspiracy theories. I'm fairly conventional when conspiracy theories are involved. I do think that there is nothing impossible about the state lying to us. Far from it. I mean, there are many proven examples of democratic states lying to us. But I think that there's something where we want to make the messy, complicated reality of history perhaps simpler, even more romantic, by stories such as Hitler escaping. I mean, why would he just stay to the end in this bunker? Where, in fact, often history is just messy and complicated. And I really think Hitler just decided in the end, yes, to wait in the bunker to the end. And when the end came, he shot himself.
Exactly. You know, oftentimes people try to, you know, they'll try to ascribe rational reasoning behind, you know, the irrationality of humans sometimes, and that sometimes bears out these theories or myths too, it seems.
Yeah, I think it's worth saying as well that conspiracy theories, I mean, I can think, I'm sure if we spent half an hour brainstorming, we come up with 100 conspiracy theories. I have no doubt that a couple of those conspiracy theories will be right, but I suspect it will be 2 out of 100. I mean, for example, I mentioned Kennedy before. I've always had an interest in Kennedy's assassination. I mean, there we have an example where the US government effectively in the late 70s said that they believed that there was more than one shooter at one point. I mean, there were strong arguments for and against, but that there is an outside chance there, I think, that there was more than one shooter. If so, the story that was sold knowingly or unknowingly in the 60s would be false. I mean, who knows if it is or isn't, but then, yes, so many conspiracy theories are just us trying to make sense, I think, of the past. And I think conspiracy theories, because they usually involve some overarching theory of people making sense of the world. You know, I'm thinking of an extreme recent British case that we're all presently being ruled by a secret alien reptile race.
Oh, David Icke.
Like this. Exactly, David Icke. I think they also have a way of injecting the numinous, the holy, into history. They give a sense that all history has meaning, all history has purpose. I mean, all my experience of history is the opposite. I find history a fairly random affair.
Interesting, yeah. Serendipitous, if you will. Okay, now the next segment on there are Wish I'd Been There moments, where you say that you'd give up everything but your wedding ring to see. So, you know, what are some of these moments you wish you could have been there for?
Well, there are many. I think one example I was thinking about today, and which I'll soon write a blog on, is in the 4th century, the Roman Empire becomes Christian. It becomes Christian under Constantine the Great and his successors, and this is one of these huge moments of change in history. I think there was nothing inevitable about it. If that particular dynasty within the empire hadn't picked up Christianity, then I think Christianity today would be, if it existed at all, would be a very small minority religion. But in the middle of the 4th century, we have an interesting figure who comes into the empire and becomes emperor, and this is Julian. And Julian is remembered by history as Julian the Pagan. He was the last non-Christian emperor, and he was an incredibly vigorous and successful man. He was a very charismatic individual. He was one of these leaders, I think, who manages to change history. Unfortunately for paganism, unfortunately for Christianity, he died relatively young. He hadn't been in the position of emperor for that long when he led his armies into the Persian deserts, and as had happened on several other occasions, met disaster there. Now, in his case, his army wasn't exterminated by the Persians, but he himself was mortally wounded. And there's a terrible moment where the spear plunges into his chest, and he's taken down from his horse. And this very romantic figure, and looking back, we can see that with his death, Christianity returns to the empire, a Christian emperor comes back, and from then on, paganism, Roman and Greek paganism, will slowly vanish from history. And Julian lies in the sands, and his teachers, the philosophers, the Platonists, who had been, if you like, his advisors, gather around him. And Ammianus Marcellinus, who gives us the best account of poor Julian's death, describes, I always think it's an extraordinarily moving passage, describes how these teachers discourse with Julian on the immortality of the soul, the idea which is very typical of Platonism, that our souls are immortal, that at death the soul will continue. And it's a very, let's say, intellectual version of paganism, but I always think to have seen this, notwithstanding all the blood and the gore, with the death of Julian, you would have actually seen the end of a whole way of civilization there just dying in the desert. And to have actually seen these teachers gathered around him and Julian talking to them about the soul, because there was this Platonist belief that by discoursing on the soul, the passage of the individual soul would also be easier, would have been, like I say, very, very moving. I'm always incredibly moved when I read about it, but to have actually seen it would have been just extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely, and kind of goes back to that moments that changed history, you know?
Absolutely, it's also a hinge moment. And I think that's something that I have these various tags and categories, and I often find that one story, one post, will actually fit into two or three tags quite easily.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah, absolutely. Well, you say you have 150 posts there already, so I'm sure, you know, they cover a lot of stuff. Now, one of the interesting posts that you had that you point out incredibly that it had never been published on the Internet is Winston Churchill's dream. So share this story with people, because as you note here, chances are they probably hadn't heard of it before.
That's right. I have to say that Winston Churchill's estate is rather aggressive, and I'm not sure that the gods of copyright, if they knew about this, would be very happy. but I think that the I'm keeping my fingers crossed and hoping that if they ever do get in touch, they'll just ask me to desist and I'll take it down. But this is one of my favourite pieces of Churchill's writing. When we think of Churchill, we think of his speeches from the Second World War that were remarkable works of English. They're very peculiar in some ways. They almost hark back, as Churchill himself did, to the 19th century. But I think many people today, perhaps especially outside the UK, forget that Churchill was also an accomplished writer. And really, I wouldn't say perhaps a brilliant stylist, but a fine stylist. And many of the things he wrote have a rare combination of wit, but also, understanding of history. I mean, Churchill was one of these people where history just ran in his blood. He was a natural historian. And one of my favourite pieces of Churchill's writing is this text called The Dream. And what's interesting about it, Churchill writes it, I think, in 47, at a time when he's the leader of opposition, leader of the Conservative Party in Britain, but he's not in office. The Labour Party is in office just in the post-war period. And The Dream basically describes a vision that Churchill claims to have had. Now, I should say at this point that I don't think that Churchill meant that the vision actually happened. I think it's his way of expressing something that he wants to get across to his reader. But what happens in this dream, this catnap of old age, is he's painting in his studio, and he's copying a picture of his father, Randolph Churchill, who was a great, if rather dangerous, 19th century conservative politician. And his father appears before him as a spirit, sat in a chair. And Churchill has a 12, 15, 18-page conversation with his father. And of course, his father, the last thing his father can remember, his father died in very sad circumstances from syphilis. He spent the last 2 or 3 years of his life, really, not being compos mentis. I mean, he was gone mentally. Mm-hmm. His brain had ceased to function. It must have been very cruel for him and his family, or particularly for his family. And his father recalls the last year he remembered in the 1880s, and Churchill basically fills him in on what had happened in the meantime. And I think, again, I'm very much a fan of the 19th century over the 20th century. I think the 20th century has many things to recommend it, but also many dreadful, dreadful things happened. And really, Churchill finds himself in the position of justifying to his father the terrible things that have happened in the 20th century. And I know of no better text that gets across to us the way in which the world, and perhaps particularly the Western world, go to hell in the 20th century. The line I always remember is Churchill describing the First and Second World War, and Randolph Churchill, Churchill's father, saying to Churchill, "My goodness, these wars sound terrible. I imagine that almost 500,000 died." And of course, Churchill replies, 20, 30 million, 40 million died in each of these world wars. Just a sense that the happier, more peaceful period, at least from the British perspective, of the late 19th century disappeared forever in August 1914 with the beginning of the First World War.
Yes, for sure. It seems like those wars definitely changed the face of the planet. And it seems like that at that point then, Europe sort of fell by the wayside a little bit as far as being the center of the world as it stands, I guess.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
And one of the other stories I saw in there for the wish I'd been there moments, which I thought was really funny and interesting, and all another story that I'd never heard before. This was the astronaut with the sandwich.
I can't actually remember off the top of my head, and this is the problem of having written already 150 posts. Which astronaut? Is it Young or...?
It was. I have it here. Let me see. It was John Young.
John Young, that's right. No, it's a lovely story. Basically, John Young, the early NASA missions into space and then later to the moon, came up with some very unappetizing food that had to be eaten. And there is this lovely story that from one of the early orbits, the astronauts were sick, and Young brings with him onto the space vessel a ham sandwich that then he takes out and that proceeds to break up. And of course, the whole problem with bringing food like this onto the early spaceships, I mean, NASA was terrified, and understandably so, that just a crumb going in the wrong place at the wrong time could destroy a spaceship. And in fact, Young was berated publicly by several US senators. NASA gave him a dressing down. And it's ironic because in the end he became, in a sense, the elder father of the US space mission. I think he's the leader of the first shuttle flight. That's right. So it's just a nice moment, the idea of this astronaut with a sense of humor bringing out this ham sandwich on one of the early flights.
Yeah, it sort of brings you back to the Wild West days of what it was like back then when they were really, you know.
I loved it. With that post, I was very interested as well to read about early Soviet efforts in space and the way that the Soviets actually had a completely different way of looking at things. Instead of having very unappetizing food, they concentrated on letting their astronauts eat good food, but putting all their technology into and efforts into making sure the food could be taken care of. For example, having special vacuums that could take in the crumbs so that there was no damage to machines. But like you say, I mean, both on the Soviet and the US side, we're back in the Wild West days of space flight there.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's also, you know, it's interesting to see the span that gets covered, you know, in the blog. I mean, we're talking about stuff that was only about 50 years old here in right now. And then, like I said earlier, you got stuff from the Roman Empire. It's amazing the breadth of material on there.
I do try and do this. When I started thinking seriously about doing a blog, I began to look around at other history blogs on the internet. And what I found was, and there are two or three very honorable exceptions to this, but what I found was that understandably people are interested in one period, often one city, one region, one subject, and they concentrate typically over a century or a generation or 50 years. And I felt that what I wanted to do was bring lots of stories from different periods together. And so what I try and do, and this is one of the few disciplines that I set myself, really there are two rules I have for myself. First of all, that I write a blog, or at least post a blog every day. And second, that I try not to do two consecutive days the same period. So let's say I do a contemporary blog one day, the day after I'll try and do an ancient blog or a medieval blog. So just I try and be changeable in that sense.
Yeah. Well, you can tell just from that sort of stylings too that you're a writer and that, you know what I mean, that you think this thing through. It's not just a hodgepodge of stuff.
I mean, sometimes to me it seems like a hodgepodge, but I'm glad to hear you say that, yes.
Oh, no, it seems very calculated on my end. So, now, what about wrong place, exotic finds, things and people from afar? This sounds really particularly interesting to me.
Basically, what I was curious about with wrong place was looking for examples of artifacts, people, technologies, ideas that turn up just in completely unexpected places, sometimes 1,000 miles away from where we would expect to find them, and sometimes really thousands and thousands of miles away. And I can give you a whole series of examples here. I mean, for example, just over the last couple of months, we've had some very exciting finds from Stonehenge and a burial. Stonehenge, of course, the great ring, the prehistoric ring in Britain. Mm-hmm. A burial there of a boy who seems to have come from Spain. I mean, how does a boy from Spain end up in Stonehenge? We have examples of Chinese coins from the Middle Ages that turn up on the east coast of Africa. We have one of my favorite examples, a Swedish ford where a medieval archaeologist digging at a Viking farm dug up a statue of the Buddha from India. We have another, the so-called Maine penny, a Viking coin that turned up in northern Maine on the coast. So I've just given you there a selection. Yeah. I mean, we have there's a lovely example of a example of Christianity in early medieval China. I mean, we always think of Christianity arriving in China at a later date, but actually Christianity arrived there very early and was then wiped out only to return later. And for me, what all these things have in common is all of them, with the possible exception of the main penny, are accepted actually by mainstream historians. There's nothing controversial about them. They're just at the very extremes of history. They're extreme examples of the way that the world was actually linked together at an early date. And we think, well, actually, in the Middle Ages and antiquity, no one travelled. And we tend to forget about the Roman boats that went through the Red Sea and travelled to the south of India. We tend to forget about the Vikings bridging the Arctic and reaching North America in the 9th and 10th century. And what I like about all of these, again, is that they're not controversial. They're simple facts, but they're facts that most people don't know about. And admittedly, they're at the very margins of history, and arguably they're unimportant movements of people, but nevertheless they're movements of people.
Yeah, and you raise an interesting point too about the Vikings coming to America, because it seems like, like you said, that it's a fairly undisputed fact, but it's still, you know, it's still not sort of like the accepted story here in America. I don't know how it is over in Europe, but it's like, you know, I think if you ask people, they sort of either poo-poo it, or they, you know, they say, well, it might have happened, when it seems like it's a fairly incontrovertible fact that the Vikings came here.
I think there were lots of things coming together there. I think one thing is that for Western Europe, and possibly also for the United States, Columbus, we fixate so much on Columbus that we just tend to forget any other evidence of transatlantic contact. The second thing is that the Vikings did ultimately fail. I mean, they backed out of North America. We have undisputed now archaeological remains from the coast of Canada that shows there was Viking settlement there. I mean, something that no Viking specialist would contest. But Viking settlement probably lasted, what, 20 years, 30 years at the most, and then they backed out going towards Greenland again. It didn't become permanent, where in a sense the revolution that Columbus begins did.
Yeah.
The other thing. Sorry, Tim.
Oh, sorry, go ahead. I see what you're saying. Yeah, I see. Had the Vikings stayed, then history would have been rewritten that way.
That's right. And something that I've never really come to grips with in my own mind, and I always keep this in my mind as an unusual fact, I mean, North America is discovered by the Vikings. The truth is that as soon as they'd reached Greenland and seen birds fly west, as soon as they'd reached the coast of Labrador and seen the trees, I mean, they were always going to get to North America when they got to Greenland. Getting to Greenland was the difficult bit. Greenland, I mean, in Greenland, Viking settlements last all the way into the 14th century and then vanish in very mysterious circumstances. I just find it extraordinary that Viking knowledge of North America never leaked into Europe. I just cannot account for that. And I suspect that it did leak in, but somehow it just got lost in translation. But really, right up until the 14th century, there were people in Europe who knew about North America. They happened to live in Iceland, people who had contact with Greenland. And yet this information doesn't seem to have made it onto Columbus's radar or onto the radar of the Spanish and Portuguese explorers. And I think it's a nice reminder that it's not enough to prove that someone's discovered something. You actually have to have a food chain that reaches from them all the way to important centres of knowledge, because this knowledge was discovered on the periphery but actually seems to have remained on the periphery.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I'm glad you mentioned that. It's fascinating that it took so long between the Vikings and Columbus for anyone to come back.
But especially given that even if the Vikings had backed out of North America, they'd remained. I mean, Greenland had a Viking community into the 14th century. I mean, it's incredible, really. I mean, the gap between the disappearance of the Greenland settlements and Columbus, you know, it isn't that long at all. I mean, it's just a bit over a century, or a bit less than a century. I can't remember the exact dates now of the Greenland settlement disappearing. sometimes within me I ask myself, is it possible that actually some of that information leaked through to Columbus? And there were attempts in the 60s or 70s to argue this, but they really came to naught. And I think the balance of evidence is no, they didn't.
Is this like the Piri Reis map? I'm assuming you know about
that. Well, the controversy is about that, and I think, again, the balance is that these maps don't really convince, or they didn't matter.
Hmm. Okay.
This is history in the making. You're going to want to tell your grandkids and their grandkids and their grandkids.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
The rest, as they say, is history.